From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, market access and currency value to top U.S.-China dialogue. Myanmar prepares for return of foreign banks. Illicit sales of ivory objects booming in Bangkok. These stories and more in this Thursday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Police in Myanmar's second-largest city, Mandalay, used rubber bullets Wednesday to disperse a Buddhist mob that was attacking a Muslim-owned tea shop. A police statement said five people were injured in the breakup of the riot, the latest instance of Buddhist-Muslim violence in Myanmar, also known as Burma. The mob pillaged other Muslim-owned shops and burned vehicles before order was restored by a large police force later Wednesday. Myanmar, meanwhile, is taking steps to allow in foreign banks later this year, providing a key source of funding in a country hungry for capital for development. Ron Corbin has more for VOA from Bangkok.
After more than five decades, foreign banks are set to fully return to Myanmar later this year as part of the government's policy reforms aimed at developing the economy and infrastructure. Foreign banks that were present in Myanmar, also known as Burma, in 1963 were nationalised after the military took power. Years of isolation from the international community and economic and trade sanctions also undermined development of the banking sector. Since Myanmar's political opening in 2011, some 40 international banks have opened representative offices offering limited advisory services. Central Bank Deputy Governor Set Ung says up to 10 foreign banks will be granted licences and will be open for limited banking services beginning in September. By July 6, a licensing panel including the Ministry of Finance, Central Bank, Attorney General's Office, representatives from the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and a German consulting team will complete a review of applications. The World Bank is recommending the new banks have a paid-up capital base of $75 million. Sean Turnell, a professor of economics at Macquarie University, says given the lack of development in Myanmar's banking sector, foreign banks could play a key role in providing much-needed capital and access to international trading links.
What does Myanmar need? And what it needs, desperately needs, is capital, right? I mean, it's got none. It's essentially, the banking system that's there at the moment is smaller than one medium-sized bank in the US. So, you need capital. Now, where are you going to get it? Well, you're going to get it from the foreign banks. You know, the local banks, firstly, at the moment, are not big enough.
Burma's banking sector remains vastly underdeveloped. A United Nations report found just 4% of the country's estimated 61 million people have a banking or savings account. Many rely on informal banking, including borrowing from so-called loan sharks with exorbitant interest payments. Myanmar is one of the poorest nations in Asia, with some 43% of the people living on less than $2 a day, and around 80% getting by on $5 a day. Banking sector development is vital to support the economic reforms, but faces challenges due to the lack of progress in recent decades, says Kopsak Putrakun, an executive vice president at Thailand's Bangkok Bank.
I think in the banking sector, the main challenges for Myanmar is how to develop their own banking system so that they can support the development of its own SME and its own local corporate, so that later on it will complement these MNC who are coming into the country.
Local banks and their supporters had tried to derail the reform legislation for fear of competition from the foreign banks. But President Thein Sein resisted the calls, insisting the reforms go ahead. The foreign banks will still face restrictions. The banks are limited to just one branch, offering limited services, including loans to foreign corporations. To lend to local companies will require cooperation with local banks. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Still to come on Daybreak Asia, a look at India's form of democracy from an author who has watched it operate and change over the past decade. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew says the pace of economic reform and the need for further appreciation of China's currency will be among the issues at next week's strategic and economic dialogue in Beijing. VOA's Victor Beatty reports Liu also does not see cyber spying as an impediment to improving relations between the world's top two economies.
Speaking Tuesday to the U.S.-China Business Council, Liu said he expects further progress at next week's dialogue. He pointed to China's commitment to open its economy more to outside investment and said that since 2010, China's currency, the yuan, has appreciated 14%.
It still needs to appreciate more. It's undervalued. And that is something that hurts Chinese consumers. It reduces their purchasing power. One of the things that's so important in terms of China's economy is to increase consumer demand. But it's fundamentally not fair in terms of trading practices, which is why we press on it so hard.
Liu said this is a threshold issue that is fundamental to the trust between the two countries. An undervalued currency tends to boost Chinese exports and hurts foreign competition. He said China has widened the trading band of its currency in recent weeks, but described progress as taking two steps forward and at least part of a step back in getting towards a market-determined exchange rate. Gary Huffbauer of the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics sees U.S. demands for greater currency appreciation as a non-starter for China.
China is tightening up credit. This is causing a bit of a slowdown in economic activity in China. Also, China has a major anti-corruption campaign, and you know, you see these generals being arrested, which is extending right down into the provinces, and that's cutting back on kind of the big projects in the provinces. One of the offsets that the Chinese government is doing to, you know, keep business going and so forth is to resist appreciation of the renminbi.
Liu says a market-determined exchange rate coupled with a more open Chinese economy will be good for the U.S. economy and American businesses' ability to compete on a level playing field.
And frankly, I think it's in China's interest. If you look at China's core economic plan, what they put in their third plenum, the issues that I've just described are central to what they've adopted as their stated program.
Liu says progress has been mixed after China's announcement of the Shanghai Free Trade Zone.
It's been a slow process. I think it started out with almost everything being put on the closed list. Now, as things are taken off the closed list, we're finding that just yesterday a list came out, so we haven't fully digested it. But on first glance, it doesn't appear to be areas of major interest for U.S. market access.
The Shanghai Free Trade Zone is being viewed as a template for ongoing negotiations on a bilateral investment treaty. Gary Huffbauer of the Peterson Institute says the slow pace of reform in China is due in part to efforts by China's new leadership to consolidate its control over the country's vast national and provincial economies. Liu praised the Chinese for their focus on enforcement of intellectual property protection, but called for a more sustained, continuous effort to establish so-called rules of the road. And he also hopes the discussion on cybersecurity, especially in light of recent allegations of hacking by Chinese military personnel of U.S. corporate trade secrets, will continue.
We do not view it as an acceptable practice for governmental entities to participate in the process of, you know, securing trade secrets for the economic benefit of firms in their country. And we've made that clear in a general way. We've made it clear in a rather specific way. And I don't think there's any question but it's a source of some difference between us.
China says it, too, is a victim of U.S. cyber spying. Gary Huffbauer says as the two sides sit down next week in Beijing, U.S.-China economic ties are much stronger than bilateral geopolitical relations, where the two sides view each other more as competitors. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
North Korea has fired two more short-range rockets off its east coast, the third such test in less than a week. News of the launch came from South Korea, which said the projectiles landed harmlessly in the East Sea Wednesday. The launches came a day before Chinese President Xi Jinping visits Seoul for talks expected to focus largely on the North's nuclear and missile programs. Thailand is reputed to be the world's largest unregulated ivory market, and despite international pressure and law enforcement efforts to end the trade, it appears to be growing significantly in Thailand's capital city. Wildlife trade monitors say an alarming amount of illicit ivory is being laundered through the legal market. VOA correspondent Steve Herman has more from Bangkok.
A new study of Thailand's ivory market shows sales of such products booming in Bangkok. The number of items in shops in the Thai capital has nearly tripled in the past year and a half, and the number of outlets primarily targeting Chinese tourists has steeply risen. According to the study conducted by the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Network, TRAFFIC, the quantity exceeds the supply legally available under a 75-year-old Thai law allowing sales of tusks from domesticated Asian elephants. Naomi Doak authored the report. She is TRAFFIC's coordinator for the Greater Mekong region.
It's not illegal to sell ivory in Thailand, so it is quite open. We just went around to each of the identified retail outlets and identified the type of products they were selling. We counted and estimated the number of each of those different products.
Thailand has no ivory registration system in place, so it is not possible to trace the lucrative product. And that, according to the TRAFFIC monitoring networks, allows a loophole for laundering illegal ivory from African elephants into the Thai marketplace. Previous Thai civilian governments have pledged to end the country's domestic ivory trade, but it's unclear how those pledges will be honored following the May 22nd military coup. In the meantime, Doak says the illegal trade continues.
You can't discount the political situation as affecting the speed of their action on this issue, but unfortunately, the poachers aren't slowing down because of political situations. They're marching on and elephants are still being killed at unsustainable levels.
Royal Thai Police Deputy Spokesman Colonel Krisana Patanacharo says Thai authorities will eventually make good on their pledge.
I'm a bit optimistic because if we really get on to it, although it takes a long time to solve the problem, but surely we will get that one day.
The police colonel says Thailand is caught in the middle of a lucrative, illicit global trade. TRAFFIC's Doak is calling on Thai authorities to acknowledge their nation's ivory trade is now out of control and fueling the African elephant poaching crisis.
We want them to do what they've been saying they'll do for at least 10 years now, which is to close or to adjust and change the current legislation that would make the sale of African ivory in Thailand illegal.
The new data asserting a significant increase in ivory objects on sale in Bangkok means Thailand is certain to face increased scrutiny at next week's meeting of the Convention on Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora in Geneva. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The death toll in a building collapse in the southern Indian city of Chennai has risen to 47 as hopes of finding any more survivors fade. More bodies were found Wednesday in the rubble of the 11-story building, which collapsed Saturday in the state of Tamil Nadu following heavy rains. Rescuers pulled 27 people out alive after the collapse. Police have arrested six construction company officials for alleged criminal negligence and violation of building codes. Officials continue to search for the cause of the collapse. India touts itself as the world's largest democracy, and of course it does, with the second largest national population in the world. India's democracy is intricate and varies in how well it functions across geographic areas and within different parties and in parliament. Simon Denyer is currently the China bureau chief for The Washington Post. He previously held that position in India for the past decade. Denyer has followed Indian politics through elections and governance and has chronicled the details and changes in its democracy in a new book titled Rogue Elephant. He tells how India's democracy has much hope in the hands of its people.
You look at democracy from the top and you see corrupt politicians who don't do their jobs very well. But if you look at democracy from the bottom up, what you see is lots of heroic people struggling to make it better, to make it function better, using the legal system to combat child trafficking, using the weapon of a hunger strike to try and force change, going into devoting their lives in villages to promoting the Right to Information Act. So these people who really are affecting change from the bottom up do create this huge pressure for Indian democracy to function better. This is one of the most important things that has to happen in India. It's no longer enough for democracy to make a nation, to forge a nation. It also has to deliver better governance. And I think that's the hopeful thing that we're seeing now, is that voters are chucking out people who don't govern well, and they're voting back into power people who govern better.
And your book covers quite a few aspects of democracy in India, from the very big picture political aspects down to the individuals through the country. And you've had a unique look at both. Let's start a little bit with your chapter on dynastic politics and how it's stifling Indian democracy.
there's a lot that's wrong with Indian democracy, and I think the dynastic nature of politics is one of the big things which doesn't work well. The Congress Party has turned into a party which is very sycophantic towards the Nehru-Gandhi family. They've basically controlled the party since independence. They've run India for more than half of the year since independence. But it's become the only glue that keeps the party together. But what's happening there is that that culture of sycophancy, that culture of dynasty, is really stifling the party now. And what it was personified in Rahul Gandhi, who's the next heir, the next generation, who really doesn't have a natural feel for politics. He's been thrust into politics because he's the next generation, has to take over. And he really failed to ignite the imagination of the voters during the last election. And I think you saw then what dynastic politics really isn't bringing to the Congress Party, the disadvantages of dynastic politics. But it's not just the Congress Party. I mean, many other parties in India are the same way. They're not democratic internally.
10 years ago, when you arrived in India, the mood of the country was very upbeat, and there was a lot of promise for the future. Things changed, though, during the tenure of Manmohan Singh. What happened?
I think that it's a very good question. I think that the euphoria, if you like, in 2004 when I arrived was overdone. India really felt it had arrived on the world stage. It was a superpower in the making. As journalists, we weren't really encouraged to report about poverty. We were encouraged to report about shopping malls and gleaming new India and IT centers and call centers and so on and so forth. What happened really was that India sat on its laurels. The government of Manmohan Singh didn't introduce economic reforms. It didn't do the sort of things it needed to do to unleash the energy of the private sector. And more particularly, it fell into very corrupt ways. And we saw the mood really punctured by two things. One was a huge corruption scandal centered around the allocation of telecoms, mobile phones, licenses. And the second was the Commonwealth Games. Beijing had staged its Olympics, and it had been a huge success and a huge advertisement for the power and the might of China. And Delhi staged the Commonwealth Games, contests for former countries that used to be part of the British Empire. It was actually a bit of a national embarrassment for India. People were coming up to me and really pessimistic about the future of India. And I felt then, and you know, that pessimism was as overdone, actually, as the optimism had been in 2004, because there is a lot of positive force for change that was bubbling up during that 10 years.
It led to a natural backlash in the most recent elections and Narendra Modi coming into power, plus the combination of the fact that social media played a huge role in this election, whereas when you first covered the elections in 2004, we really didn't have as vibrant a social media in India as we do now.
Yeah, in fact, the media and the social media have played really key roles from 2004 to 2014. The growth of 24-hour media in many, many different languages, in all the languages of India, really putting politicians right there in people's living rooms and in people's villages. The middle class really realized that they needed politicians to govern. They needed politicians to ensure law and order. They needed politicians to deliver infrastructure so that they could do business. Twitter and Facebook and 24-hour media really brought that home and really got the middle class engaged once more in the political process.
Well, as much as you write about the big picture of democracy in India, you also touch on individuals in your book. And certainly Indians, along with the technology, were empowered with the Right to Information Act.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the most used Right to Information Act anywhere in the world, something like 7 million requests filed every year, and it's growing year by year. That's given the poor a much greater voice. Because in the past, the bureaucrats who ran things didn't have to answer to the people. They just answered to their bosses. And the Right to Information Act gave ordinary people the ability to question decisions and brought a level of transparency and accountability into the bureaucracy, that bureaucrats had to answer to the people. And that's a massive change because, in fact, bureaucrats felt they were the lords of the village or the town or the district, and they didn't have to take into account what people really wanted. They could make arbitrary decisions, and those decisions would stand. The Right to Information really gave the poor in India a voice
they have a voice through elections, but another voice, another way of exercising their power and their rights. And that's fundamentally very important in a society where caste is still important, where people are still supposed to touch the feet of their elders or bow their heads to their superiors. This gave people the chance to raise their heads and ask difficult questions. And I think that in any democracy, that's a good thing.
Simon Denyer, currently the China bureau chief for The Washington Post. Following a decade of reporting in India, he's the author of Rogue Elephant, Harnessing the Power of India's Unruly Democracy. It's published by Bloomsbury Press. Well, the power of foreign buyers of apartments in new condominium towers are evident in New York City. They're flooding into the area where even the highest-end real estate is a relative bargain compared to many world capitals. Canadian, Russian, and, of course, Chinese buyers make up the bulk of these foreign investors in Manhattan's prime neighborhoods, some paying in the tens of millions of dollars or more for apartments sight unseen. VOA's Carolyn Weaver has a report.
157 West 57th Street will soon be the tallest residential building in the Western Hemisphere, overlooking New York's Central Park. Still unfinished, many of the units have already been sold, including two that reportedly went for more than $90 million each. 157 sales director Jeannie Woodbury shows a smaller apartment listed for nearly $19 million.
The ceilings obviously are 10 foot 7. This is our lowest ceiling height. And Christian de Portzenpark, who is the exterior architect, designed walls of glass. So you really have no break in the views whatsoever. And that's really the drama in all of our apartments.
About half the new owners are from outside the U.S. Nikki Field and Daniel Chang, brokers at Sotheby's International Realty, frequently travel to China to meet new clients.
Most all of them were drawn to the United States.
That's right. Yeah.
Why was that?
Well, I think U.S. has very stable political environment. It's kind of put a safe deposit box in a city that it will pay for itself, it would appreciate, and they don't have to worry about any property being confiscated.
157 will soon be overtaken by even taller, equally slender and costly apartment towers going up near Central Park. Chang says Chinese buyers want this location.
The first thing came to their mind is Central Park. So most of my clients want Central Park views and building surrounding Central Park.
Chinese buyers recently outnumbered Russian purchasers of Manhattan real estate for the first time. They now are second only to Canadians, like dual American citizen and part-time New Yorker Diane Francis.
We're the solution, not the problem, to your economic issues, to your income inequality. We employ people, we spend billions, we invest here.
Francis says the world's wealthy are buying luxury apartments in New York as investments or as a safe harbor.
Some of them are fleeing regimes that they're concerned about destabilizing, or currencies they're worried about. Or in the case of China, and I'm not saying this, I don't want to besmirch all the Chinese that are coming to New York and will come to New York and the United States to buy real estate, but there is a crackdown on corruption in China, and a lot of people who have hidden away money that they haven't told the government about want to get it out. And they're getting it out by buying a condo here in someone else's name.
To critics, the ultra-luxury apartment towers are a sign of rising inequality. Many remain empty most of the year, and owners whose wealth is acquired outside the U.S. don't pay income tax. Some new luxury buildings also receive huge property tax breaks. Even defenders agree the trend is driving up real estate prices throughout the city, making New York increasingly unaffordable for those who are not rich. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
While we don't necessarily enjoy a penthouse view out of Studio 23, the vast panorama of the latest world news is next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces...